I didn't know the power of my mother's cabbage soup. You know? Unbelievable. I figured maybe tonight I would talk about my favorite subject, and I would talk about your favorite subject, at least in the beginning, and I have a reason. My favorite subject is me. Okay. Okay. It also happens to be my mother's favorite subject. Don't tell my brothers. Okay. And your favorite subject, of course, is you. So if I tell you a little bit about me, I think, you know, we're all in a situation that if one person talks about themselves, there's enough of a common denominator that we'll all found a little bit of ourselves in each other. As Mark had mentioned, I grew up in a little town called Eastchester in the county of Westchester. You can already hear the confusion. You know? Which way am I going? You know? East or west, young man? You know, both were pulling at the same time. And my family, my parents had, we were probably some of the most, you know, religious people around. My grandmother used to turn the whole house upside down on Pesach and light Friday night candles. And my mother did everything that my grandmother did without any deviation. But that's all we did. We went to Hebrew school. Hebrew school was Mondays and Wednesdays and Sundays, or Tuesdays and Thursdays and Sundays. And the whole goal was just to get to the bar mitzvah. I had two older brothers. And it was a little bit of a nuisance, and the whole job in being, the task in being in Hebrew school was to get kicked out of Hebrew school, because there was a candy store across the street, and they had these Israeli teachers that didn't know anything about, so much about really Yiddishkeit, but they knew some Israeli culture, and they didn't know too much about teaching, and so, you know, we were very capable of getting underneath their skin. You know, we didn't like being there, they didn't like having us, and it was a, you know... mutual, you know, non-admiration society. You know, so it didn't leave such a, you know, a deep and lasting impression. And of course, come the bar mitzvahs. My brothers had a bar mitzvah. They opened up hefty bank accounts. My bar mitzvah, it was the last day of my Jewish education, basically. Also, we were in public school there. We had gone from Queens to this place in Westchester County at a nice, nice public school. There was a smattering of Jews in this lower middle income place, which is sandwiched between New Rochelle and Scarsdale. The people in East Chester did the lawns for the people in Scarsdale and worked in the stores. But the Jews, we all knew who we were. You know, it was like a little wink and a nod. And I remember even when it came time for the graduation, the high school graduation, people gave little Jewish stars and little winks and nods and keep the faith and the, you know, amazing little things that we had never acknowledged to each other that we knew that we were Jewish. So, I was in high school. I was captain of the high school football team. I was captain of the high school basketball team. I was captain of the high school baseball team. I was involved with all kinds of different things. I was in the choir. I was treasurer of the choir. Okay, my kids don't believe I was ever in any choir, you know? And my wife doesn't believe I was ever the treasurer of anything. You know? And my goal was to get to a good college, maybe get a scholarship or something like that. And in spite of all the and on top of all the extracurricular activities that we had going on. So I insisted on taking responsibility and paying for all my, you know, extras, you know, clothing and t-shirts and jeans and all this different type of stuff. So I worked in a Jans, okay? Don't anybody react here, because then we'll know who you are, okay? Anybody remember the kitchen sink, you know? So I was working in a Jans at night after school. And that was my first exposure to anything religious. There was a bunch of guys over there that were, I would say, born again. You know, we're in a shul over here. They were born again guys. You know, they were running all over the place. And I was just the busboy and washing dishes. And they were always trying to anoint me for some reason. They were trying to pour oil on top of my head. You know, and I kept on telling them, guys, I'm not the salad. Please leave me alone. And then after work, we go out in the parking lot. We toss the ball around, and after cleaning up. And they would look up at the sky and they say, you know, like, don't you see there's a stars and that there's an organization, there's something going on here. And I said, let's get down on our knees. And I remember from Hebrew school that a Jew doesn't get down on his knees. So I never got down on my knee. That much stayed with me. And I said, I asked them questions. So what does that have to do with a Jew that died 2,000 years ago? I mean, like, there's a few missing pieces over here. And since they were trying to pressure me, I resisted the salesmanship. And I said, I'm leaving my big decisions in life until I've had a chance to digest, you know, most of Western literature and to see what the great philosophers and thinkers, you know, what they all have to say about the big questions in life. So I'm not really educated enough to make any clear decisions. And so I got a full scholarship to Colgate University. I went to Colgate and I did my 4 years over there. In my freshman year, coming back from Thanksgiving, my best friend was killed in a car accident, and I was like vaulted to a new level of consciousness. Came back to what people were pledging for the fraternities, nay, who drinking, and it was like a real Animal House party scene. And I told college students when I share with my personal story with them, I said, you know, but that was 30 years ago. I said, I'm sure things have improved since then. Yeah. So I became a little bit, you know, I don't know, how do we say it? I became a little disappointed, being gentle over here with the and cynical about the approach. You know that I was looking. I came looking for meaning. I came looking for value, and I saw that the seniors were more drunk than the freshmen. I ended up going on a trip to Eretz Israel, my first time I missed the baseball season. In the spring, and ended up working in a kibbutz, picking grapefruits. We went to Haifa University, got a nice grade point on, you know, Israeli conflict, this and that. But I left the country after 6 months, no more attached to my people and the country. Although I did have later on, I realized I had certain experiences over there. I had gone to the Western Wall and I had planted a little prayer in there. If you're there, God, please show me. I didn't realize until 5 years later, 6 years later, when I was already in yeshiva. But at that time, it didn't last. It didn't make any conscious impression on me. I hitchhiked through Europe. I did all kinds of different things. And by the time it came time to graduation, so graduation time, everybody was learning how to shake hands in order to get nice jobs with corporations and high-paying jobs, and also to going to graduate school, to medical school, and to law school. Very, very nice. Very fine. But I felt at that time in my life, I didn't have a clarity. Everything I had done before then, I did with all my heart and all my soul and all my might. And here, now, you know, I felt, I described it to myself as the fast track to nowhere. You know, where's everybody going now? Down this long Skinnerian box, you know, where the next journey is now that people are going to have to invest themselves. They're going to take the next 20, 30 years to pay off the debts that they're going to accumulate, and they're committing themselves to things that they don't even know what they're getting involved with. So I put on my yellow blinkers and I let everybody go past me. I had this picture in my brain at that time that, and I don't know where I came up with this, I ran to the edge, to the end of the highway, to the end of this scene, and I said I'd been pretty successful at everything else I had tried. I said, maybe I'm going to be successful at the American dream also. And I'll work for IBM for 30, 40 years. And they'll give me a gold watch. And I'll retire with, you know, with a house in the burbs with, you know, 1.7 kids and a dog or something like that. And at that moment, you know, I'll see a bird flying across the horizon. And there'll be a big puffy cloud in the sky, and the bird will fly to the distance where you can't see him anymore. And at that moment, I'll take my last gasping breath in this world, and I'll say, what was I supposed to do with my life anyway? And then leave the world disappointed. So I didn't want that to happen. So there was a pounding inside, and I don't know where it was coming from. And I decided, you know, after trying a few different things, there was a little voice inside that says, go help somebody, go make a difference in somebody else's life. A friend of mine who had graduated a year before, who was part of the subculture, the Puerto Rican black community at Colgate University. I mean, those were the chevra that I felt, they were like Hamish. You know, I always felt, you know, good with them. So a friend of mine who graduated the year before said, come join me. He says, you know, I have a school for high school dropouts. And he went back to his community to help, to see if he could pull up other people from the bootstraps. So I said, you know, hey, great, you know, so I'll come. And I'm going to be a job counselor. I'm a job counselor. So I felt like the guy with the bumper sticker says, don't follow me, I'm lost myself, you know. I'm going to help them get on the fast track to, or the medium track to where, to what, why, you know. It only begged in me a lot of other questions, like, where am I going to lead them to? You know, like the thing in the airplane, to put your, you know, oxygen on yourself and then on your junior companion. I didn't have a source myself. I wasn't anchored myself to pull anybody else. I started fishing around and looking for anchors. So here I was working my first job in the Bronx as a job counselor and a GED teacher with these Puerto Rican kids. And we had always asked different people in the community to come and speak to us and give us some inspiration. We need some inspiration. Some local entrepreneurs or people who were actually hosting in their job sites different students that we had. And so my job was placement, and I was in touch with the people. So we invited this one fellow, very elegant, handsome, you know, Sidney Poitier, you know, black fellow, and he was running a nursing center in the Bronx. So I said, would you come, please, and speak to our school? Our students would love to hear, you know, what you have to tell them. Give them some chizuk. I didn't say chizuk, okay? So he said, yeah, I would like to speak to them. He says, but I don't feel like coming to the school. I said, why not? He said, because he said, I used to be a curator in the Metropolitan Museum of Art. I'd rather take them to the Metropolitan Museum of Art. Fine, fine. So we arranged two buses, took 80 students to the Metropolitan Museum of Art. And this was going to be one of those life-altering moments that you never know when it's going to happen, right? And here we were, he had showed them, black art, and he showed them Indian art, and he showed them Spanish art. And then after he was finished showing them, he sat everybody down on the marble floor, the hallowed halls of the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and then he went into his little speech, his drasha that he had for us. And I'll never forget, you know, he explained to me, he says, why did I bring you here? Why did I show you black art and Indian art and Spanish art? He says, because this is where you people come from. He says, the Puerto Rican personality is made up of these three streams from Europe and from Africa and from the native Indian. He says, and they're all woven into your personality. He says, and sometimes, he says, what happens is the person doesn't like what they see, looking at them in the mirror, looking back. He says, the black doesn't like the Indian doesn't like the Spaniard, this white man doesn't like the Indian, doesn't like the Spaniard. He says, there's a civil war going on inside. He says, and it's hard for a person to feel whole when all these warring factions are going on simultaneously. And I'm sitting there listening. He says, the first time I've heard something in years that made any real, you know, common, deep common sense. And he says, in order to know where you're going to in life, he says, now he's starting into his black Baptist ministerial cadence. He says, in order to know where you're going to in life, he says, you got to know where you're coming from. And here I was, I'm standing off to the side, I'm the teacher, and I'm nodding my head, almost chuckling, you know? I'm nodding my head, you know, you know? And with my arms folded, I used to come to work with jeans and a t-shirt, you know, just for, out of respect, and karate slippers, you know, that's how, you know. Not that I knew anything about karate. I had these little Chinese karate slippers, and I still wear the same ones for Yom Kippur, okay? Anybody can get it? Zeche Lechorben, you know? So I'm wearing my karate. Not that I knew anything about karate, but I'd seen enough John Carradine movies or whatever, you know? I knew how to drop into a stance, and I knew how to say, I'm obligated to tell you that my hands are registered weapons. You know, like, I knew a few stances and how to give that look, that far out look, like, you know, that people are enough to call my bluff, whatever. Nobody ever called my bluff, thank God. I was working with tough kids in the tough neighborhood. And so that was part of my MO. So here I am off to the side. I had long curly hair. I had hair back then. Okay. I had long curly hair, you know, like a Jufro, that's what they called it. Right? And flowing down my back, and I'm there with my arms folded, sort of like, you know, showing off muscles and, you know, intimidating. And I'm there listening to the guy, you know, Julio, put the knife down, okay, you know listening to the band, you know. The mashgiach listening and sort of and getting into what he's saying and watching the students seeing if everything. And I'm sort of an observer, but half participant. And he says, in order to know where you're going to in life, he says, you got to know where you're coming from. He says, Bob over here, that's my English name, don't tell anyone, okay? He says, Bob over here, he knows where he comes from. He's a son of Abraham, right? And suddenly I've got this finger pointed at me, right? You know? And I felt like Bambi on the highway, you know, with the headlights bearing down, you know? The guy asked me an innocent question. I'm thinking to myself, you know, that wasn't my bar mitzvah parsha, you know? Neither was my brother's bar mitzvah parshias, you know? And I'm stuck. The first responses that came up to my brain, I have to tell you, and again, when somebody asks you a question like that, you better have a response within about, you know, a third of a second, you know, or a second and a half, or else, you know, you got to say something. But I my mind was flooding, like when you press the search button in the computer, like answers were, and I remember all of them, because I'm in a public moment, I might embarrass myself. And I'm thinking to myself, that's anti-Semitism, you know? Yeah? And I said, no, that's not appropriate. He didn't say anything anti-Semitic, you know? And I had other prognostic responses like, you know, hey, this is a government program. Now he's mixing government and religion, you know, at the same time. What about the wall? There's a wall over here. And I'm going to start mentioning the Constitution. It's not going to apply. No one's going to look at me. He asked me a question. You're a son of Abraham, right? So suddenly flashes into my mind from my youth, from the days I was in Hebrew school. Suddenly I have a picture of a day I spent, I think it was in third or fourth grade, and I remember even the art project we had that day where we took a cover of a, we took a piece of cloth and we shredded the reds to make like a challah cover. And then we had this other cloth book called The Heroes of Jewish History. And somewhere in the beginning of this little brown book, there was a picture of a man and a woman schlepping a camel wearing white garments behind them. That was in the top, that was a third of the page, two thirds of the page. And the bottom third of the page starts a story about a man named Abraham and Suri for coming from a place called Ur. And I remember chuckling about the name Ur. That's what they came from, Ur. Right, you are. You know? Yeah? And suddenly I flash back to that day, Abraham, you know, slipping the camel, you know. And so a second and a third goes by, and the guy says, son of Abraham, right? You know, and after getting rid of all those negative, inappropriate responses, I said, that's right. Now that I agreed to this thing in public, so suddenly I'm like, wow, you know, what am I? Who am I? I rush home. I get to my mother's house. There I had parked all the books that we collected from each of us spending the collective 12 years of college that my brothers and I had packed into this one room. But that was only one third of the books. So I have my oldest brother has the highest IQ ever recorded in the school district. He had read, you know, and he could recite James Joyce chapter and verse, you know, backwards and forwards, and Einstein and Marx. We had liberal arts education before we went for the liberal arts education. There we used to have interesting discussions. We had tens of thousands of books packed into this room. I went up to the top shelf and I saw three black Masoretic texts that we each had received from the Genesis Hebrew Center, which is now a Korean center. Okay, just change the clientele, but I think the theology is pretty much the same, you know. And there we climbed up to the top shelf, and I saw these three black texts over there. I can tell from the gentle geologic slope of dust on top, since I was the youngest one, which one was probably mine. There, I pulled it off. I opened up. Those were the only books whose backs had never been cracked. The books had never been opened. And I started flipping through Abraham, what Abraham, who Abraham, why Abraham, where Abraham. And suddenly I find some portraits, some pictures, of a man sitting in front of a tent and someone else starting on a journey at the age of 75. And I'm saying, wow, I'm like dusting off like family portraits. And I felt like someone had gone up into his attic and now found pictures of, this is who my, you know, you're related to the Chazanish, you're related to the Ben Ish Chai, you're related to the Vilna Gaon, you're related to the Chofetz Chaim. Here I am, I'm opening up and I'm dusting off this is my family tree over here. And I walked away from there feeling and said, wow, I know who my great, 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 I spare you a couple of greats, grandfather is going back 3,500 years. And my heart was pounding inside because I had always seen myself as some, you know, little American kid that maybe is going to go into politics or law or something, in some local kid, a baseball player that had, you know, gotten a scholarship to college. And now suddenly I see myself at this long end of a giant chain. And I'm this fruit that's shaking at the edge of the tree. You're a son of Abraham. I know who my great, 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 great grandfather is. And I started doing research here and there, left and right, all over the place. I looked back in the books and I went to the library to get other books to find out if there's anybody else on the planet that has that type of credible information about a single individual that they can trace their family back to. You know, the Chinese from the Ming Dynasty and this dynasty, can they find, did they say that this is their ancestor? No. Even if they're going to go back further, they're not going to find anybody that they have any credible information about. And so the more I researched this, the more my heart started to swell with pride, and I would go up in the subways, up in town and downtown, and I would, you know, you can't look at people, but, you know, I would look out from behind my book into the reflection in the mirror when they would, you know, in the windows, and I'd say, I wonder if that guy knows who his great, 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 great grandfather is. I wonder if that guy knows who his great, 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 great. And the more I thought about it, the more I realized that I'm in a unique position in the world. And so I walked around with this feeling, this incredible feeling. And then after a couple of weeks, I realized I'm looking at it all wrong. And I asked a question that put me into high gear. And the question was like this. I said, I'm looking from my point, looking down the end of the highway from my self-centered position, saying, oh, I know who my great, 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 great grandfather is going back those 3,500 years. But then when I started to read a little bit, I realized I'm also missing information. I would like to know even more. But where do I find out more? But the thing that started to trouble me inside was, how did he make his impression felt 3,700 years into the future? How did he make his impression? What type of father would I have to be if I wanted my children or my grandchildren or my great-grandchildren to know or care who I ever was? You know, what type of child was I to my parents that when my parents told me to take the sneakers out of the middle of the room, they're still sitting in the middle of the room, right? Nobody ever took them out. You know, who are you talking to? Me? You talking to me? You know? You're thinking that. You know, we didn't have respect. I wasn't as bad as some of my kids from, my friends from Scarsdale, who used to call their parents by their first name, you know? Boy, Phil and Sue are really having a hard day today, you know? Who's Phil and Sue? The folks. You know, like, you know? But, you know, what type of respect was there? What type of, you know, where were we going with this? And I'll tell you the dirty little secret is, I didn't feel like having children. I was so saturated with bad news and thoughts of nuclear proliferation that the sword of Damocles is hanging over the world. I wouldn't want to bring anybody into this dirty kitchen, into this world. I didn't think it was a mitzvah. I didn't think it was a right thing to do, especially if you don't know what to teach them. So this bothered me. What did Abraham and Sarah do? So I'll just tell you one of the things that started to work within me, that started to percolate within, And that is, I started to write a little diary for myself, for whatever reason. At a certain point, I decided, I'm just, you know, I spent my whole life footnoting and writing to get entry into something and writing for this and writing for the newspaper and writing for the, you know. I sat down with a piece of paper. I wrote on top of the paper, what do I know, with a tall legal pad? Let me just get down to the bottom of the page and figure out, what do I know? And I don't want to have to footnote, and I don't want to have to, you know, prove it, and I don't want to have to go to the library. I just want to know, what do I know? What is real? And I get down to the bottom of the page, and I turn over the page another day, another time, and I start on top of the page, and I ask another question, another important question. What lasts? You know, where am I going? Where is this all leading? You know, whatever, general, local, I get down to the bottom of the page, and wherever I went to the bottom of the page, I always came up with one thing that really surprised me. And it kept on pounding. This particular theme kept on repeating itself, and I couldn't avoid it no matter where I started. And that theme was, there was a word over there, one, on the bottom of the page. One, 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 one. I couldn't get away from the word one. That there's something, there's a unity, there's a powerful unity in the world. Then I always thought, as a good Jewish boy growing up, I would cover my eyes at night and go to sleep, and I would say, math, English, social studies, science, okay, literature. Because these are the subjects that we took, and I thought that life was divided into those into those subjects. Then you get into university, you know, and you start to do the weave. You know, it's the science of history and the history of mathematics and the mathematics of art and the art of science and the science of ooh, you know. Now we're combining. We're doing cross-disciplinary work. You know, ooh, you know, ooh, this is getting, you know, this is, you know. But I remember one French philosopher had written. I had underlined it, but I underlined everything in the book, so I could never find it again. You know, that, you know, all science is one. You know, and I realized, you know, that somehow there's a palpable oneness in the world. That it's one. Seamless reality.